Welcome back, everybody, to a big day at the Damage Report. It is the day, of course, that later on we'll see the third, I was gonna say round of Democratic debates, but this time it is just one. 10 of the candidates who qualified for this debate are gonna be duking it out on stage down in Houston, I believe. And of course, throughout the day, we're gonna be doing more coverage of that. Not only, you know, we're gonna talk about it a little bit here. We got the main show. Cenk Uygur is off in Houston. He's going to Skype into the main show a little bit later on today. Talk about what's going on there in advance of the debate. And then we will be doing full coverage with a full panel, Anna Kasparian, Emma Vigilan, Nando Villa as well. Cenk is gonna be Skyping in during that coverage to talk about what happens. And it's potentially a big one. It's a smaller crowd. All of the front runners are, for the first time ever, on the stage together. Joe Biden is actually going to be standing directly between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, which is probably not where he wants to be. And so very exciting, very consequential. The stakes are very high in this debate. I'm sure that tomorrow morning we'll be talking about some of the highlights of it on the Damage Report as well. And for that show, Emma Vigilan is gonna be joining me once again. So it should be really big. For today's show, we got a lot and a lot of guests. So Fred Guttenberg, Parkland dad, is gonna be joining us in the next section. He recently had a meeting with activist Alyssa Milano and Senator Ted Cruz about gun control. We're gonna see if anything positive came out of it. Does it actually increase the chance of gun control passing? We'll try to find out. A new anti-depression drug with some significant theoretical problems being pushed on the VA. We're gonna have analysis of that later on. And also aspiration.com working to help you understand what corporations are doing right with your money. When they go out there and they invest it, is it benefiting the world? Is it advancing your values, or is it doing the opposite? We're gonna be talking about that. And also Crystal Ball attacked by Rush Limbaugh. A deranged sexist attack. We're gonna show some video from her show on the Hill TV a little bit later on. But first, the vaping ban. So let's get right into that. As of yesterday, big changes coming to vaping. So there's been some significant health concerns, lots of sicknesses, 500 cases of a vaping-related respiratory illness, number of deaths as well, and the federal government has sprung into action. I'm gonna show you a video of Donald Trump talking about it, and there's a fun little tidbit in there as well.
But we can't allow people to get sick, and we can't have our youth be so affected. And I'm hearing it, and that's how the First Lady got involved. And she's got a son together that is a beautiful young man, and she feels very, very strongly about it. She's seen it, we're both reading it. A lot of people are reading it, but people are dying with vaping. So we're looking at it very closely.
Okay, so obviously serious topic. We're gonna get to the serious stuff in just a sec. But two interesting things there. The weird tell. He has a number of tells. One is a lot of people are learning about it. Like a lot of people are learning about something when he is for the first time learning something. Nobody knows when he doesn't know. Those are two important tells going forward with Donald Trump. But I love that there. He's like, Melania, she's got a great son together. We together, I'm his dad, we have a kid. We care about our kid, not just Melania. What a weird, I don't have any kids. Is that a thing? Is that a weird slip up that you make that you forget that you're involved in that process, that the kid is also connected to you? I don't understand. But look, I don't know if Melania's concern for Barron's respiratory health is actually what's leading this. I sort of doubt it. But I understand, parents are really worried. The vaping, e-cigs, they have become much more popular in recent years, in no small part due to the flavors that are available that are being targeted now by this federal ban. So the Health and Human Services Secretary said that the FDA would outline a plan within the coming weeks for removing flavored e-cigarettes and nicotine pods from the market, excluding tobacco flavors. The ban would include mint and menthol, popular varieties that manufacturers have argued should not be considered flavors. Outside of anything else having to do with the merit of a ban, that's sort of a weird argument to make. The idea that mint isn't a flavor, because it sells well, obviously. It's a flavor, tastes like mint, I would assume. So that's sort of weird. And understand that this new action, which is coming up in a few weeks, follows action just earlier this week, where on Monday, the FDA took action against Juul, one of the most prominent companies in this area, sending a warning letter accusing the company of violating federal regulations by promoting its vaping products as a healthier option than cigarettes. And as I said, they are becoming much more popular. 5 million minors, mostly in their high school years, reported that they'd used e-cigarettes recently. About 1/4 of the nation's high school students reported vaping within the last 30 days in this year's annual survey, up from 20% last year. So that's a significant number. And initially, my impression had been, because look, I admit this is not something that I know a lot about. I have a, you know, one relative who vapes. That's really the extent of my personal knowledge with it. But I had assumed that young people who have always, you know, dabbled in smoking and all that had transitioned from cigarettes to e-cigarettes, that they had sort of taken over that market share. But the numbers actually show that the regular cigarettes use plummeted. And then sometime later, the e-cigarettes started to become more popular. So to that extent, these companies are sort of stepping into a vacuum and re-stimulating interest in these sorts of things. Now, that is not to say that having some sort of blanket ban on a flavored version of a product necessarily makes sense. And let's just briefly note that if everything about this story was identical, this is a game we often play, everything was identical, but Obama had done it when he was president. Can you imagine how Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, what their shows would look like tonight if Barack Obama said, oh, this product that's dangerous for you, we're going to be banning it? There would be chaos in Fox News. Now that, again, is not to say anything about the merits of a ban or not. Let's just acknowledge that difference here. Look, if they want to make it more difficult for young people who are not even supposed to be using these products in the first place to get them, okay, that's the sort of regulation that we have certainly seen before. It is interesting, though, that this huge action, this is fairly unprecedented. You know, we've seen things like this in Europe, but in the US, fairly unprecedented as a result of these cases of respiratory illness, which are apparently not even necessarily linked to the products being banned here. And six deaths. So six deaths happen, not necessarily even linked to this product, but federal government leaps into action. These products are going to be banned. But what about other products? You know, a lot of people have pointed out that there are a lot of other things killing people that the federal government sort of ho-hum in comparison to, and they're killing a lot more than six people. It's led to some good Twitter activity. Jess Dweck tweeted, vaping is very bad for children's health, and I'm glad to hear it will no longer be allowed in their concentration camp cages. That's a huge issue that the government is not only not acting on, they're actually acting in the opposite direction. Bernie Sanders responded to this ban by tweeting, now do AR-15s. And look, that's obviously devastating. It's both obvious and obviously devastating. Guns kill way, 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 way more people than flavored cigarettes, but can't do anything about that. Can't do anything about that. I guess that the e-cigarette companies just don't have enough influence yet to get the sort of protection that others do. But that's not to say that Trump won't theoretically reverse what he has already announced this week, or possibly in the future back off a little bit. After all, these are corporate profits that are potentially being affected. And as we know, with virtually every elected official, but especially Republicans and Donald Trump, that's very much on their mind, which becomes clear in another section of that same video that I showed you earlier.
Your announcement today, are you concerned that the companies that were making these products will be treated unfairly by taking these products off the market?
Well, they've become very rich companies very fast. And the whole thing with vaping has been very profitable. And I want companies, look, you know that, I fight for our companies very hard. That's why I'm fighting with China. That's why I'm fighting with other countries. If you look at European Union, and if you look at Japan, and if you look at so many others, including South Korea and many others, we're constantly dealing with them to make it good for our companies, because I view it as jobs. I view it as income for our country and jobs.
Fighting with China, what a bizarre, there's many countries, Korea, many China. But anyway, he's fighting for corporations, and that's what we understand. It's just a question of how powerful, how much money have these corporations donated to politicians. That'll help you decide whether or not they're protected or not. And we really have a perfect example of that in the news right now. So look, vaping kills six people, arguably. Leap into action, tamp it down. But what about other things that you put in your body? So we had huge progress, according to the media, with the opioid crisis. So you have the Sackler family, the family that individually has done more to push opioids on the masses over the past few decades than literally anyone else. There's been so many legal actions against them, and now a settlement this week. And under the deal, the Sackler family is going to pay $3 billion in cash over 7 years. And there's also reformulating of their corporation, all of that. Some of that actually looks like it's designed to protect them from further legal liability. You see that and you think, oh my God, $3 billion, go government, you got them. But did you get them really? $3 billion, that family alone has an estimated worth of $13 billion. They're gonna be paying this over 7 years. They will make far more than $3 billion over the next 7 years. And importantly, the settlement does not include an admission of any wrongdoing in this case. Now, what wrongdoing could they admit? Well, they could admit that in a perfect world, the world we do not inhabit, they inadvertently put out a product that got lots of people addicted and tens of thousands have died. I would feel awful if I produced a product that did that, but that's not even the world that we live in. They knew from their internal studies that people were getting addicted. They knew that it was being overprescribed in no small part because of the efforts of them and other companies that were profiting off of this. They were pushing it on more and more people, flooding the market, knowing that it was then being resold to people who don't even have these conditions. And as the body count racked up, they tried to hide the evidence. Those internal studies that they commissioned, they tried to pretend that that information wasn't there. They knew what they were doing, they knew that they were killing people, and they just went on. And so because they have lots of money, they can afford to throw $3 billion, never admit that they did anything wrong whatsoever, and theoretically go back to profiting off of medication. It's not to say that the settlement isn't good in some ways. Hypothetically, you know, it's a little bit of money. In the future, more money will go to dealing with the crisis, and possibly this will help to limit the expansion of these sorts of products in other marketplaces around the world. All of that is good. But the fact that a company like this, a family like this, individuals like this can lead to the deaths of tens of thousands and not even have to admit that they did anything wrong, that is everything you need to know about the approach of our government to corporations. So the e-cigarette companies, apparently that family's not influential enough. They can ban the whole product line because some people died. But when it comes to opioids and other huge industries, including firearms manufacturers, what can you really do? Maybe you get something, maybe you get nothing. Anyway, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The nonsense about this being a Republican or Democrat issue has got to stop. When the bullets shoot you, God forbid they should ever hit one of your kids. When the bullets shoot you, they don't know if you're a Republican or Democrat. They only know they're likely to kill you. And we need to agree on that.
So right there, you see the recent meeting between Ted Cruz, activist Alyssa Milano, and Fred Guttenberg, who's making a devastating and powerful point there. And thankfully for our audience, he now joins us on the Damage Report. Fred, welcome back.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. It's, you know, obviously a very tense day, but you're very excited to have you here, especially coming off of this really important meeting. I'm curious, going into the meeting, like, what were your expectations?
You know, I didn't go in there with a lot of expectations other than the senator and I having an opportunity to see each other as just two people on different sides of the room. There's no doubt about it. But two people who hopefully share a goal of wanting to reduce gun violence in this country and the amount of people who are dying because of gun violence in this country. You know, everything, you know, beyond that in terms of how to handle it, I really didn't expect us to come to agreement on in that meeting.
You know, I have to say, I did like your strategy that was displayed there in that clip. And like very often coming from the other side, we have to try to stimulate empathy on the part of the other side. And obviously, you try to talk about it in terms of his family. You know, you tragically lost your own daughter in the Parkland shooting. So you know as well as anyone can what that's actually like. And so I'm curious, like, how would you rate how it went? Did it seem like he had an open mind during the meeting?
You know what? My hope is that if the Senate actually does take something up, that he could potentially now be someone who would support it. He definitely has different positions on how to do this. But I do believe this. If you look at all of his Twitter before that meeting, he refers to people like me as against the Second Amendment, as wanting to take away his rights to defend himself. That's been removed as an argument. And I hope that was made clear to him. There's nobody trying to remove his right to defend himself. There's nobody trying to remove his rights to the Second Amendment, which I believe in. I am simply trying to find a way to connect with him to keep those who intend to kill away from weapons.
And that is obviously a laudable goal. It's a tough one with him. I mean, I don't hide the fact that he's one of the Republicans I have the least interest in the Senate because of his commentary about a number of issues, including this one. But now we do have Congress back in session. And all the signs from the media are people want to make a deal. The Democrats are coming in, you know, fired up. They're ready to go. Maybe Mitch McConnell will allow something. If you had to make a prediction at this point, what do you think the likelihood is that either sort of shallow gun control will pass or something significant will pass?
You know, the only element in this entire process right now that gives me hope with regards to the Senate is the fact that Senator Chris Murphy has stayed so deeply involved in it, because I have faith in him. I don't in Mitch McConnell. When Mitch McConnell says things such as, well, the way it works in this town is we have to wait on the president for direction, that is a sellout of democracy. That's a sellout of his constitutional obligations. The way we all grew up learning about democracy was that the House and the Senate, they put together their versions of a bill. They come up with a bill that they can agree on. They send it to the president for a signature. That's the way it's supposed to work. And Mitch McConnell is giving up on his constitutional obligations. I'm also getting annoyed with the Democrats in the Senate, especially those running for president, who have the opportunities to use the theater of their office to put more pressure on him and to do more than just say, we need to wait on Mitch.
Yeah, I certainly agree. So you know what? We have a great opportunity here later today. There's going to be a debate. If we're lucky, fingers crossed, there will be one question about gun control. What would you like to hear a candidate say today? What stance would you like a candidate to take?
I would like to hear the candidates talk about the most pressing risk with weapons, and that's the 300 million that are already out there. Mm-hmm. And it's because background checks work to deal with the future of purchases. How are we going to deal with the reality that there's 300 million weapons already out there? So for sure, background checks are a part of dealing with that, but we also need to seriously deal with extreme risk protection orders. We need to ban high capacity magazines. And I also want to hear them talk about ammunition. If you want to deal with the 300 million that are out there, you must deal with ammunition. That's why I've been fighting so hard for Jamie's Law, which would extend background checks to ammunition. Mm-hmm. Because if you're a prohibited purchaser of firearms, but maybe you're already in possession of firearms or you're getting them through private transfer, they don't work without bullets. And the problem is prohibited purchasers of firearms are also prohibited from buying ammunition, but there's no requirement for a background check for them to do so.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that Mitch McConnell is at least saying, whether it's true or not, that he, you know, I can't act until Donald Trump lets me know what he'll allow,
which is
exactly the dereliction of his responsibility to the American people.
Yeah.
And look, Donald Trump has retreated even recently from some of his past positions where he pretends he's okay with background checks when the NRA gives him a phone call. So I'm curious, so you're so tapped into this. It seems like the NRA has been damaged quite a bit over the past few years, and yet they still have their foot on Donald Trump.
You know, listen, they do. And I ultimately, I think the NRA members are going to rise up. Because the NRA has been damaged because they've misrepresented their membership and they've handled their membership terribly. The NRA has served the purpose of gun sellers only. They've taken membership dues. They've used it on things like haircuts and vacations and suits and trying to buy a house for Wayne LaPierre. But they've not served their members. Think if the NRA was true to their word about wanting to do the right thing, they would actually be the biggest proponents of a gun safety message. They would want to keep the guns out of the hands of killers as well. But they're lying. And they deserve the punishment they're getting. And the fact that our current occupant of the White House refuses to release the grip that they have on him is pretty pathetic. But candidly, for me, he is irrelevant right now. The person who needs to step up is Mitch McConnell.
I couldn't agree more on a number of different issues, actually, but especially on this one. Fred Guttenberg, as always, thank you so much for your advocacy on this issue and for joining us today on the show.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, another guest is going to join us on the other side. The VA is potentially on the verge of getting a new type of antidepressant, but is that actually a good thing? Let's jump into it. Back in March, the FDA approved the esketamine nasal spray Spravato for treating severely depressed patients who don't respond to other drugs. It represented the first truly new kind of depression drug since Prozac arrived way back in 1988. This is, of course, significant because suicides claimed more than 47,000 lives in the US back in 2017 alone. And for severely depressed patients, there is an increased risk of suicide. Now, there is a rush to get this ready because the VA was advised by President Trump to buy the Johnson & Johnson drug and ASAP. And so there's been sort of a time crunch there. But psychiatrists and medical researchers, including some of the VA, have raised questions about the drug's effectiveness and safety. During their trials, three people who had taken it committed suicide and three others died, as opposed to none on placebos, though the FDA said there was no evidence the drug and the deaths were linked. Still seems sort of significant. And thankfully, we're now joined by the reporter who did that reporting. This is Peter Carey, business reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
I'm very glad to have you here. This is an interesting situation going on right now. The deaths that happened on this drug, how seriously should we take that? The FDA says it's not connected, but should we be worried?
I think common sense tells you that they ought to be looked at closely or more closely. I mean, really, six people died during the trials on this drug while no one died on the placebo. There were about an equal number of patients on this drug versus the placebo takers. This is supposed to be an antidepressant and, quote, anti-suicide drug. And yet three of the people who'd taken this drug during the trials died from suicide. Mm-hmm. One of them, one person died 26 hours after taking the drug in a motorcycle accident, one 3 days after taking the drug by his own hand, and two others died a couple of weeks after taking the drug also.
That is devastating. And so we've got those deaths. What do we know about other side effects? Are they significant?
The other side effects are significant. There's an out-of-body sort of experience, hallucinogenic effects, high blood pressure, and even some additional or new onsets of depression. So all of those things are very worrisome. For that reason, the FDA, I'd say the wise heads at the FDA, the careful people at the FDA, the pharmacologists and psychiatrists are trying to go very slowly with this drug and treat when patients are treated with it, to try to treat them with great caution. For instance, if they take the drug, they need to stay in the doctor's office 2 full more hours just to make sure that they don't have some sort of immediate reaction. And they can't drive an automobile for 24 hours after taking the drug. But unfortunately, I think our president just rushed the VA, tried to rush them, and to some degree had some success, rushed them into trying to get this drug out to patients. All of which was done, I think, you know, incautiously. And had the cooler heads at the FDA prevailed, this drug would have been rolled out in a, you know, in a much more careful and judicious and efficacious manner.
So based on your research, I'm curious, he gave this directive, you got to get this thing ready for patients now, go, go, go. I'm curious, is there any reason to believe that, considering all of the other corruption stories in the news, that there's some sort of business connection there, that Donald Trump or anyone in the administration could be making money off of Johnson & Johnson having these new contracts? Or is it just, you know, a regular lack of caution that it seems like a good thing and so he wants to rush it out?
Well, the latter, the one you just mentioned, is certainly a possibility. I don't think we've seen any signs of a, you know, some sort of nefarious business connection. But personal connections seem to me to be quite, if not likely, at least suspicious. The Trump is very good friends with Woody Johnson, who's the heir to the Johnson & Johnson fortune. He lives at the Trump International Hotel. He's given Trump millions of dollars for his campaign. And he's now the ambassador to the UK. At the same time, Trump has been taking advice from an interesting trio of people who he connected with down at Mar-a-Lago, who sort of been helping him shape his VA policies. And those people have been working with Johnson & Johnson through the last couple of years in sort of working with Johnson & Johnson and the VA toward suicide prevention. So you could see any, at least those two, maybe any other likely channels through which the president would have learned of this drug and then thought, wow, you know, I want to go down as being the president who really helped the vets. So here's something I'm going to do for the vets that's great. I'm going to demand that the VA buy, quote, truckloads of this drug. Well, the whole thing is crazy. I mean, the VA doesn't buy truckloads of anything. They just wait until doctors, you know, prescribe the drugs, and then they give them to the doctors. Either go to the pharmacy or they order the drugs from the manufacturers, but they don't come in the truckloads. They come in one at a time, you know, to treat the patients who need them.
Yeah, and so the whole getting truckloads of it is a concern, both because they don't do that, but also because there would be a great cost associated with that. Can you tell us a little bit about the comparison of Spravato's cost in comparison to other antidepressant drugs?
I can't do that for you. I can tell you that Spravato is considered to be a high-cost drug, and a couple of sort of nonprofit agencies have looked at its costs. It's at least $300 for one dose from that inhaler you're showing on your screen, and originally it was estimated actually to cost double that, and there's no telling how many doses people will need. The other issue, of course, is as to how much of the Spravato doses will be covered by insurance. And I think that's still an open question, partly because the cooler heads at the VA decided not to put this drug on their formulary. Their formulary is sort of the list of specified drugs and approved drugs that would be readily available to doctors if needed. This drug was put not on the formulary, taken off the formulary because the people on the formulary committee were concerned about its efficacy and its dangers. So the only way patients can even get the drug is that if a doctor decides that this is the only appropriate medicine left for them to take for their depression, then the doctor has to fill out all sorts of forms and paperwork and that sort of thing and submit it up through the VA channels so that the patients can finally take a chance with this drug.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned efficacy there, because there's one more point I want to touch on. And in your reporting, you talk about there's not only the side effects and the deaths, but there's also apparently significant concerns about whether, for fairly large sort of groups of patients, whether it has any effect at all. Could you talk about that?
Well, yes. I mean, that's a really interesting question. The whole FDA approval process for this was skimpy, shall we say. It had signs of being hurried, and it violated the norms of the previous sort of trials that had been used for other similar drugs. In this case, to put it in most simple terms, this drug scored in the best trials, in the one or two trials that were seen to be efficacious. This drug scored about 4 points higher than the placebo on a scale of 60 points. So you can see that even in the best of cases, it didn't seem to be that much more effective. Second, there were no trials that showed this drug to work for people over the age of 65, and there were some serious questions among researchers who looked at the data as to whether this drug even was effective for men. The VA patient population, as you might guess, is about 90% men and over 50% people over 65.
Yeah. So those are, I think, to put it mildly, some significant concerns about the use of the drug. Peter Carey, business reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We'll take a short break here. When we come back, a little bit more for you. We've been talking for a long time about the effect of big money on politics, a damaging effect on the climate, on your health. This year, we've been focusing on a more personal angle, how your money could be being used by big banks and others to subvert your values. And in that, we've been working with Aspiration, a financial institution that tries to do it differently, to have your money work in support of your values instead of against it. And we're joined now by Chief Impact Officer for Aspiration, Jessica Jackley.
Welcome. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Glad to have you here.
Glad to be back.
We want to talk about Aspiration, obviously, but we also want to talk about your work in trying to make partnerships with companies that are going to be responsible with people's money. So talk to me about that work.
Absolutely. I'll start from the beginning. Aspiration is a financial institution that wants to empower people to align their spending and their savings and their investments with their values. So part of that, first and foremost, is transparency about the fact that none of the money that is in any of those accounts that I just mentioned will ever touch fossil fuel, you know, fossil fuels, firearms, political campaigns, private prisons, things like that, which amazingly, a lot of big banks, most of them, are heavily invested in.
Yeah.
You just don't talk about it a lot because who would want to do that? So that's sort of the ground level. On top of that, this is all context for the exciting news about today. Mm-hmm. On top of that, we have what's called AIM scores, aspiration impact measurements, where when you swipe your debit card, whenever there's an AIM scored company, you get a number, 1 to 100, that tells you how good that company is to people and planet. Mm-hmm. The top of the top of those AIM scored companies, we incent people to shop with them because we believe it's the right thing to do and we want to nudge people towards better decision making and to align those values, right? To align their spending with their values. So those that are within the top third and that meet other requirements are part of this new program we're launching today called the Conscience Coalition.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So leaders in conscious capitalism, like Tom's and Warby Parker, Reformation, Feed, whether it's because they have a really strong philanthropic component, whether it's because there's many different factors, many different metrics that we look at. Mm-hmm. But they basically are leading the way and saying to the world, there's a better way to do business. And companies that ask and answer questions responsibly about sort of long-term sustainability, we believe, are the ones that will win. So we think good business is the best business, and we're trying to back those, provide up to 5% cash back for now. It could get higher in the future with more partnerships. Mm-hmm. When our customers shop with those companies.
Yeah. So you mentioned a minute ago that we don't talk about how the big banks invest in these industries, but I would go a step further and say that I think almost nobody even thinks about it. I don't know if you asked me 5 or 10 years ago that you get that your money is being used, that they're benefiting from it, but you never think about the fact that it could be for a private prison, it could be for a fossil fuel company that you would never invest in yourself.
Never.
But this is actually worse because your money is being invested, but you're not even getting the gains there. It's going to another big business.
Amen. It's true. It's like while you sleep, your money's doing pretty sketchy things. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult. It's been very difficult to find that out. Luckily, now that places like Aspiration exist, the question is coming to the surface and people are starting to say, wait a minute, it seems like a neutral decision, right? It seems like my money's just sitting in a bank, but it's not.
Yeah.
So people are starting to be able to ask, where is that going? How is it being used? What am I a part of that I might not want to be a part of?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think like for people who might like be turned on to, oh my God, that's the thing I should think about.
Yeah.
Let me take a look at what sort of companies I'm supporting.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work. Hypothetically. And so to have that work done for you, both in making sure that the money as it's sitting there is not going towards those industries, that's important. But also, as you said, that AIM score, getting clued in when you're doing these purchases is important as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's funny because most of my work in the last two decades has been in the social sector. And for those that have worked in that space, whether it's for for-profits, nonprofits, I'm agnostic as to structure. There are a lot of great organizations doing wonderful things for the world. Once you kind of know that the data exists, it's a whole other question. It's a whole other process to go find it, to synthesize it, to remember what you read in this article or from this data provider that might apply to where you're going to go get gas the next day. But to have that real time with the swipe of your card and to know that, okay, I went to this, I can't afford my Tesla yet, so this gas station has a 65 associated with it, and this one has a 51. That starts to give you that steady drip of information can start to educate people little by little about the power of every dollar. I think it's easy to kind of be asleep at the wheel, so to speak, and not and by no fault of the majority of consumers, right? We don't know. It's very hard to match
and
that.
And we're busy.
Behavior. And we're busy. But to have this slow, steady, daily education that says this isn't a neutral choice. Mm-hmm. You're not just, you know, I envision a future that I think Aspiration is helping to create where we won't be able to, there won't be an excuse for sort of shopping blindly and just going around and getting things without really understanding what that means and who you're supporting. Because there are sides, I think.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's good guys and bad guys, and there are companies that are doing amazing things and are worth investing in and worth supporting. And then there are companies that you probably want to avoid, and it's hard to figure out who those are.
Yeah, and so, look, talking good guys and bad guys,
I
mean, the fact that your money won't go towards destroying the environment, that's really important to me personally.
Yeah.
In terms of the good guys, you mentioned some of the companies that are on this initial list of 16 companies. If you want to mention any others, feel free. But also, will that group expand in the future? And if so, how do you go about doing that evaluation?
That's a great process. It's funny, it's a great question. We're right in the middle of designing sort of the next tier, the next cohort, and figuring out what that looks like. We have thousands of companies that we know have AIM scores that are worthy of sort of inclusion.
Really, thousands?
So
that's impressive.
Let me caveat this. So we're moving to a new system within the next like few weeks. I don't want to give anything away, where our coverage will be expanding so many dozens and dozens and dozens. Exponentially, let me just say that.
Mm-hmm.
So we will have many thousands of companies that you'll be able to, that we'll have AIM scores on, that we'll have information about. And so from that set, it'll be really wonderful to be able to look and say who is in the top third, okay? Who also is leading in particular areas that have that have stories that really should be told, that will be inspiring to customers, but also to other companies. So that's one way to get at it. There are other signals, you know, there are B Corps. A company is a B Corp that says a lot about the commitment they've already made to avoid climate destruction, to, you know, to step up in other ways and provide social benefit to all of the people kind of in that they touch, whether it's workers, community, customers beyond. There are lots of other kind of third-party affiliations and associations that point to leaders. And so we're actually in the process right now of targeting our next select group of leaders in the space.
Cool.
Yep.
Well, when you put together that whole list, I would love to see those at the bottom of it. Maybe we could put together a sort of like Razzies for horrible corporations here.
Oh my gosh.
That would be fun, an award ceremony to point out the worst people.
That is a great thought. It's a great thought.
And so look, today we're focusing on, you know, how you can be a little bit more informed about where your money's going in terms of supporting corporations. Obviously, there's a lot of personal incentives to working with Aspiration. So I definitely advise you look online. We have a partnership too where you can get a short membership at TYT for signing up. Jessica Jackley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you. And thank you for not wrecking the environment. I appreciate that.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, we're going to take one last break. We come back. Crystal ball targeted by Rush Limbaugh. We'll break it down after this. Being online and a purveyor of the news can be rough. And if you're a woman, it is far, far worse. That was revealed today by Crystal Ball, a host and friend of the show, who talked about how she had been attacked by Rush Limbaugh on his program yesterday. Here she is talking about it.
Here's what Mr. Limbaugh said about me. Remember the name Crystal Ball with a K? Some thought she was attractive. She was running for Congress and she got elected, not true. And some tweets came out. She posed nude when she was 14 or 15. She was outraged. How dare you, I said. What do you expect to happen? You put a picture of yourself nude on Facebook or MySpace or, you know, my butt, whatever it is. Somebody's gonna find that stuff. So first of all, I did not pose nude when I was 14 or 15. Facebook and MySpace did not even exist when I was 14 or 15. You know, I didn't tweet about anything related to that. I think what he's referring to here in a very bizarre way is the fact that when I did run for Congress, there were some party photos that came out of me that caused like this.
Dumbest scandals.
The dumbest. And so I think in the Trump era, this was so minimal that it was party photos that he felt the need to make this much more salacious in order to titillate his audience. So look, you know, something like this happens, you're like, do I just ignore it? Or do I want to say something about it? And the bottom line is, number one, he's got millions of followers, fans, and this transcript is out there online. So I wanted to correct the record. Number two, you know, not everyone has the platform that I have to be able to call him out and set the record straight. And I don't want to feel like he can just slime whoever he wants and get away with it with no accountability. But number three, if I did have some naked photos from when I was 14 or 15 or whenever, who freaking cares?
Yeah, she's 100% right on every one of those points. It wouldn't be an issue. It shouldn't be an issue, even if she had done it. And of course, she didn't. And she pointed out, Rush Limbaugh is a guy that likely has many listeners. I don't know if it is actually millions anymore, but he has a lot of people who listen to him. And he brought up a story that is not news, shouldn't be news, but he did it. And he got every one of the facts wrong. Do you think he will lose a listener as a result of getting every one of the facts of a complete non-story wrong? I kind of doubt it. There's no responsibility. There's no like repercussions for that sort of thing. He was wrong all over the place. But much more importantly, why is he bringing this up? Why is he talking inaccurately about a story that, best case scenario from the right wing point of view, seemed important years ago, back when she was running for Congress? I can't say for sure, I don't know for sure, but I do have a theory. It's because Crystal Ball is outspoken and progressive. She's a strong proponent for her values and for the policies that she supports. And especially recently, she has had a great deal of success in pushing for Medicare for All, striking back against politicians like Rahm Emanuel, who are embraced by DC and, you know, the establishment. She's been talking about Bernie Sanders and his chances in winning this primary. She was talking yesterday about how a recent poll about how well he's been doing in Texas. And so she has been out there as a champion of her values. And the right just can't accept that. A champion at all, but especially a woman. That destroys them. And so they have to try to destroy her. Even if it's completely inaccurate, their tactics, even if it's pathetic and weird and misogynistic and pervy, that he thinks that if there were 14-year-old nude photos of her, that he should be directing his audience to them, knowing that it's to titillate his audience, that they would go looking for those photos that don't even exist. And that's what he's doing, because she's out there, she's strong, she's unapologetic, and so she has to be destroyed. And we see that all over the place, by the way. I can say that female journalists that I work with, including Anna Kasparian, Emma Vigeland, are attacked constantly in a misogynistic fashion. The vast majority of the time, it is coming from the right, but not exclusively. When they hold Democratic politicians accountable, they are viciously attacked. Rape threats, death threats, doxing, all of that. This is just what it is to be a female journalist, and it's pathetic. And I think that we need to fight back against it. Everybody needs to be an ally of those who are just trying to do their job. They're just trying to talk about their values. They definitely need our support. Crystal Ball has done nothing wrong. She's done everything right, and she doesn't deserve any of these sorts of attacks. Okay, just really fast, I wanna read one review. So Online Thunder said on iTunes, pretty good podcast with some good evidence-based points. but it's skewed to the far left a bit and gave us only 3 stars. So thank you for the 3 stars you gave us. We've never tried to hide our slant, but we appreciate you watching the podcast. Thank you for everybody who's done those reviews. Tomorrow, Emma Vigeland, we'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.